reading of the Fort Dodge Messenger for Monday, September 26, 2022. I'm your reader, Janet Griffith. Starting on today's front page, the first headline reads, Off-Road Proposal. Off-road utility vehicles could be allowed in FD. City Council to consider plan at tonight's meeting, by Bill Shea. Off-road utility vehicles would be allowed on Fort Dodge streets under a proposal to come before the City Council tonight. Drivers of those machines would have to take the shortest route to and from designated utility vehicle routes, much as big trucks have to take the shortest route to and from truck routes. The proposal is in response to a law signed by Governor Kim Reynolds in June, which permits registered off-road utility vehicles to be operated on non-interstate highways and paved secondary roads. According to the Fort Dodge proposal, only machines with 4 to 8 wheels and bucket or bench seats would be allowed on the city streets. Off-highway vehicles that a rider must straddle to drive would remain illegal on city streets. The council will discuss this proposal during a workshop to begin at 5:30 p.m. today in the Municipal Building, 819 First Avenue South. The council's regular business meeting will begin at 6 p.m. in the Municipal Building. During that session, the council will consider the first of 3 required readings of the off-road utility vehicle ordinance. The council will also consider buying property in the 200 block of South 8th Street to create a new education area for the Blandin Memorial Art Museum. The museum's art classes have been held in a small basement room. Museum leaders have long wanted to move the classes out of that room. The proposal before the council calls for the city to buy buildings at 222 South 8th Street, 224 South 8th Street, and 226 South 8th Street from Grell Properties, LLC, for $185,000. The Blandin Charitable Foundation would then reimburse the city, paying back the $185,000 over 10 years. Next from today's front page, calendar standoff ends in arrest. Wanted suspect barricades himself in a house Sunday, by Bill Shea. Calendar. A man wanted on a domestic assault charge barricaded himself in a Calendar house for 2.5 hours Sunday afternoon before being taken into custody. The situation brought a large number of law enforcement officers to the area of Agnes Avenue and James Street. No one was injured and the man surrendered without a struggle after being confronted by a police dog. Sergeant Tony Walter of the Webster County Sheriff's Office identified the man as Adam Larson of Calendar. Walter said he was patrolling Calendar shortly after 1 p.m. and spotted Larson walking. He knew that there was a warrant for Larson's arrest on a charge of domestic assault. I hollered at him to stop and he ran into the house and barricaded himself, Walter said. The house Larson ran into is at 801 Agnes Avenue. The house was surrounded by law enforcement officers while other officers went inside to find Larson. Walter said the officers did not initially find the wanted man, so an Iowa State Patrol canine was sent in. The dog located Larson in a crawl space of the house. At that point, he reluctantly gave himself up without getting bitten by the dog, Walter said. Larson was arrested on the domestic assault warrant, and Walter said he believed he would also be charged with interference with official acts as a result of Sunday afternoon's situation. Larson was booked into the Webster County Jail and was expected to make a first appearance in magistrate court this morning. Webster County Sheriff's deputies were assisted by Calhoun County Sheriff's deputies, Iowa State Patrol troopers, Rockwell City Police, Iowa Department of Natural Resources conservation officers, and state motor vehicle enforcement officers. And the last item on today's front page is titled Moving Forward in Rockwell City. Wagner works with Revitalization Group to spruce up town, attract visitors. By Deanna Meyer. Rockwell City. As he flew over, said the crow, Rockwell City is a place to grow. If you've driven into Rockwell City from the north recently, you were likely greeted by this rhyme on a set of 4 roadside signs leading into town. The poem's sentiment is simple but accurately represents how Joan Wagner feels about her hometown, a place she wants to see grow. Born and raised in Rockwell City, Wagner is passionate about her community. She, along with a handful of other like-minded residents, have been working together since 2009 to improve the place they call home through a group known as Rockwell City Revitalization. This community group was behind the addition of the sequential roadside signs, also known as Burma-shaped signs, which were a popular advertising gimmick the company used to promote its shaving cream from 1925 to 1964. Rockwell City Revitalization was initially a branch of the local chamber. Wagner has been a member since its inception and today serves as president. We met and tried to come up with different things that could help the town, kind of spruce it up, revitalize it, she said. From the beginning, the group developed a vision for both physical amenities and community attractions that would benefit the town. Among the first projects the group would tackle was bringing a bandstand back to the city square. There were a couple of people that were really passionate about it and pushed until we had enough money to do that one, Wagner said. We thought it was a place where we could have events in the future. In the mid-1900s, a gazebo graced the courthouse lawn, but Wagner said the original one couldn't be recreated. So the group raised the money to build a new one, and it has since been the site of several outdoor concerts and events, including the Bill Riley Talent Show. During COVID, we had people bring their own lawn chairs and spread out, she said of the summer concerts. Sweet Corn Days is another community event that evolved from those early meetings. The summer celebration has since been taken over by the chamber. Today's revitalization group consists of less than a dozen members whose mission is to revise Rockwell City by leading the way to enhance our community, neighborhoods, and quality of life. Over the years, several major projects have been completed due to the group's efforts. Among those is the Rainbow Bridge on the east side of town. Closed in 1981, the bridge eventually became an eyesore. It was just overgrown, then we cleaned it up, she said. In addition, a family donated a picnic table and a plaque was made for the area. Now it's a roadside park where people can fish off the historic Rainbow Bridge, Wagner said. Other projects the group has supported include demolishing unsafe buildings on the city square, getting billboards on U.S. Highway 20 directing people into town, and turning bare concrete into gardens on 4th, a small downtown park with benches, tables, and flowers. Kids Kingdom, a playground inside the city park, is an ongoing project. We've kind of adopted Kids Kingdom, Wagner said. The group has had it power washed and sealed and also makes sure equipment is repaired and up to date. In the summer of 2021, the group revamped a tennis court into a pickleball court. With a new net and new court lines, which Wagner painted herself one Saturday morning using special stencils, the court was soon ready for use. Of all the group's projects, however, Wagner especially enjoys the concerts at the gazebo. They're relaxed, low-key. The concerts are free to the public and often draw people from outside Rockwell City. The bands that we have, they have followers, she said, so certain people from out of town come when they find out that they're playing. We started out with small local bands, and now we're actually paying for the talent. We get sponsorships, which helps cover the cost. Meanwhile, the group has many other projects on tap. It's considering adding a sand volleyball court near the swimming pool and is working on a new dog park, which will be located near the Calhoun County Museum. Asked why she stays involved, Wagner said simply, "If we don't do it, who's going to?" Wagner also serves as the Calhoun County Assessor. I started in the office in 2000 and worked my way up, she said, becoming assessor in 2005. In addition, she is a member of the Church Council at St. Paul Lutheran and Presbyterian Church and helps her husband farm. Her passion for serving goes back to family. She and her husband Colby have raised 2 children here, and now those children, Tyler and Faith, are grown and beginning to invest in the community themselves. It's a good place to raise your kids, she said, and the things that we do to help keep Rockwell City moving. And there is a note on this article from the editor. It's titled Hometown Pride and says this story first appeared in the Messenger's annual Hometown Pride publication on June 24, 2022, featuring people and organizations from Fort Dodge and the surrounding area who are making a difference in their communities. And continuing with local news from inside the paper, this title is It's a Chocolate Thing, Sweet Support for Gateway to Discovery by Kelby Wingert. Chocolate lovers are invited to enjoy some sweet treats while supporting a local women's addiction recovery program. The 9th annual It's a Chocolate Thing fundraiser for Gateway to Discovery is October 1st at the Webster County Fairgrounds. The event will run from 1 p.m. to 4 p.m. in the East Auditorium. Admission is $20 per person, with children 12 and under free. Guests can enjoy an array of sweets created by local talented vendors, visit the hot chocolate bar, and bid on silent auction items. Gateway to Discovery is a faith-based nonprofit residential support program that helps women struggling with addiction through a 2-year residency program. In addition to providing treatment classes and a safe living environment away from old social circles rife with substance abuse, the Gateway to Discovery program funds graduates with a humble stipend. Participants also help run the Hope Sweet Hope Studios shop. The program doesn't receive any government funding, so it relies on community contributions, and the Chocolate Fest is the biggest fundraiser of the year. Our program is solely based on donations from the community, and this fundraiser is the majority of the money that helps our women to be rent-free for 2 years while they live in our house so they can focus on their recovery, said Lindsay Roll, program coordinator for Gateway to Discovery. This year, Gateway aims to make this year's event the biggest ever and raise $30,000, which would have a huge impact, Roll said. It would definitely carry us through for the next year or year and a half, she said. We would be able to do some updates to the house and do some other things recovery-related for the women, like retreats and stuff like that. Sober activities are really important. Since opening in 2013, Gateway has served several women in the community with its two-year residential program. Graduates and participants in the Gateway program will also be at the chocolate event to talk to guests about the program and to celebrate recovery together. Our graduates are all thriving, Roll said. Without this program, I don't know that they would have made it. Josie Paul, who is now the coordinator for Gateway's social enterprise Hope Sweet Hope Studio, was the program's first graduate in October 2015. Now moving on to national and international news in today's paper. This title is Three Wounded in Shooting at Amusement Park Near Pittsburgh. West Mifflin, Pennsylvania, Associated Press. Three people, including two teenagers, were wounded by gunfire late Saturday at an amusement park southeast of Pittsburgh, which was kicking off a Halloween-themed festival. Allegheny County Police said a 39-year-old man and two 15-year-old boys sustained leg wounds in the gunfire shortly before 11 p.m. Saturday at Kennywood Park in West Mifflin. Park security responded along with local and county police, who were working a security detail at the park. Emergency responders took the man and one of the youths to a hospital where the man was treated for a gunshot wound to the leg and released. The youth was admitted with a gunshot wound to the leg, and another youth grazed on the leg was brought to the hospital by a relative. Both teens were listed in stable condition. Witnesses told investigators that two groups of teenagers were involved in an altercation in front of the Music Express ride, and shots were fired by a male wearing a black hooded sweatshirt and a dark-colored COVID mask. A handgun was found near the scene, police said. Kennywood posted a statement on Twitter around 12:30 a.m. Sunday, saying the park had been closed for the night and all guests had exited. The company said it was closely collaborating with police as they investigate. "We are greatly saddened by the violence that occurred last night," Kennywood said in a statement Sunday afternoon. "Our thoughts are with those who were injured as a result of the incident, as well as all guests and team members affected by what happened." Kennywood said, "Park entry security protocols include a state-of-the-art weapons detection system, as well as video scanning and bag checks, as well as the presence of county and local police." The park's website also said weaponry of any kind is strictly prohibited at the park. Police are investigating using the park's security cameras and witness statements, KDKA-TV reported. County police asked anyone with information or video to contact investigators. The Pittsburgh Public Safety Department said in a social media post that its officers were assisting. Kennywood was celebrating the first night of its Phantom Fall Fest, scheduled to run through October 16th, according to the park's website. The park will be closed Sunday with tickets dated for that day, good for any other day of the Phantom Fall Fest, and is to reopen Friday, the park said on its website. The website bills the park as a family fun destination featuring 7 roller coasters and rides for children. Ward Trutchell of West Mifflin told the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette that he arrived at about 9:45 p.m. Saturday and saw way too many unaccompanied minors. He said he left about 10:30 p.m. because young people were being aggressive and trying to start fights. As he left, groups of at least 100 ran past him two or three times, Trutchell said, calling it a scene with lots of chaos. Thomas Harrison of Irwin told the Tribune Review that he was with his fiancée and parents when the shots were fired, and then people were screaming, running, and pushing each other to get out of the park. Tropical Storm Ian strengthens as it heads to Cuba, Florida. Tallahassee, Florida, Associated Press. Authorities and residents in Florida were keeping a cautious eye on Tropical Storm Ian as it rumbled ominously through the Caribbean on Sunday, likely to become a major hurricane on its path toward the state. Governor Ron DeSantis has declared a state of emergency throughout Florida and urged residents to prepare for the storm to lash large swaths of the state with heavy rains, high winds, and rising seas. Forecasters are still unsure of exactly where Ian could make landfall, with current models plotting it toward Florida's west coast or panhandle regions, he said. "We're going to keep monitoring the track of this storm, but it really is important to stress the degree of uncertainty that still exists," DeSantis said at a news conference Sunday, cautioning that even if you're not necessarily right in the eye of the path of the storm, there's going to be pretty broad impacts throughout the state. The National Hurricane Center said Ian is expected to become a hurricane on Monday and reach major hurricane strength Tuesday. Flash and urban flooding is possible in the Florida Keys and Florida Peninsula through midweek, and then heavy rainfall was possible for North Florida, the Florida Panhandle, and the Southeast United States later this week. The agency placed a tropical storm watch over the lower Florida Keys on Sunday evening and has advised Floridians to have hurricane plans in place and monitor updates of the storm's evolving path. Wiley seal that cruised to pond surrenders, Beverly, Massachusetts, Associated Press. A gray seal that wandered into a Massachusetts pond and evaded authorities' attempts to capture him turned himself in Friday after waddling up to the local police station. The gray seal first appeared earlier this month in Shoe Pond in the city of Beverly, northeast of Boston. The animal is believed to have traveled to the pond from the sea via a river and drainage pipes. The seal quickly became a local attraction and was even named Schubert after his chosen pond. Firefighters and wildlife experts used boats and giant nets in an effort to capture the animal Thursday, but gave up after several fruitless hours. Early Friday morning, however, Schubert left the pond, crossed a parking lot, and appeared outside the side door of the local police station, looking, according to a police statement, for some help. GOP divided on no exceptions abortion ban. Texas governor vowed to eliminate rapists. Austin, Texas, Associated Press. When Texas' new abortion law made no exceptions in cases of rape, Republican Governor Greg Abbott defended it with an assurance Texas would get to work eliminating rapes. 1 year later, Lindsay LeBlanc is busy as ever helping rape victims in a college town outside Houston. The numbers have stayed consistently high, said LeBlanc, executive director of the Sexual Assault Resource Center in Bryan, near Texas A&M University. Despite hiring two additional counselors in the past 6 months, she still has a wait list for victims. We are struggling to keep up with demand, she said. The constant caseloads in Texas are another example of how Republicans have struggled to defend zero-exception abortion bans that are unpopular in public polling, have caused uproar in high-profile cases, and are inviting political risk heading into November's midterm elections. A year since Texas law went into effect in September 2021, at least a dozen states also have bans that make no exceptions in cases of rape or incest. The absence of exceptions has caused divisions among Republicans, including in West Virginia, where a new law signed this month allows a brief window for rape and incest victims to obtain abortions only if they report to law enforcement first. Recently, South Carolina Republicans scuttled a proposed ban after failing to get enough GOP support. It really disgusts me, said Republican South Carolina State Senator Katrina Sheely, ripping into her male colleagues on the floor of the state Senate. Republican U.S. Senator Lindsey Graham, also of South Carolina, allowed exceptions under the proposed national abortion ban he introduced last week. The proposal has virtually no chance of passing, with even GOP leaders not immediately backing it, reflecting how Republicans have broadly struggled to navigate the issue of abortion with voters since the U.S. Supreme Court overturned Roe v. Wade this summer. Overwhelming majorities of voters think their state should generally allow abortion in specific cases, including rape, incest, or if the health of the pregnant person is endangered. Even Republicans are seeing it as a line with some voters. Russia's call-up splits EU. Ukraine says it shows weakness. Kyiv, Ukraine, Associated Press. Russia's rush to mobilize hundreds of thousands of recruits to staunch stinging losses in Ukraine is a tacit acknowledgement that its army is not able to fight, Ukraine's president said Sunday, as splits sharpened in Europe over whether to welcome or turn away Russians fleeing the call-up. Speaking to U.S. broadcaster CBS, Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky said he's bracing for more Russian strikes on Ukraine's electrical infrastructure as the Kremlin seeks to ramp up the pressure on Ukraine and its Western backers as the weather gets colder. Zelensky warned that this winter will be very difficult. They will shoot missiles, and they will target our electric grid. This is a challenge, but we are not afraid of that, he said on Face the Nation. He portrayed the Russian mobilization, its first such call-up since World War II, as a signal of weakness, not strength, saying they admitted that their army is not able to fight with Ukraine anymore. Zelensky also said Ukraine has received NASAMS, air defense systems, from the U.S., NASAMS uses surface-to-air missiles to track and shoot down incoming missiles or aircraft. Zelensky did not say how many Ukraine received. Although the European Union is now largely off limits to most Russians, with direct flights stopped and its land borders increasingly closed to them, an exodus of Russian men fleeing military service is creating divisions among European officials over whether they should be granted safe haven. The partial mobilization is also triggering protests in Russia, with new anti-war demonstrations on Sunday. In Dagestan, one of Russia's poorer regions in the North Caucasus, police fired warning shots to try to disperse more than 100 people who blocked a highway while protesting Russian President Vladimir Putin's military call-up, Russian media reported. Dozens of women chanted no to war in the Dagestani capital of Makhchkala on Sunday. Videos of protests showed women in headscarves chasing police away from the rally and standing in front of police cars carrying detained protesters, demanding their release. Women also protested in the Siberian city of Yakutsk, shouting no to genocide and marching in a circle around police, who later dragged some away or forced them into police vans, according to videos shared by Russian media. At least 2,000 people have been arrested in recent days for similar demonstrations around Russia. Many of those taken away have immediately received a call-up summons. Unconfirmed Russian media reports that the Kremlin might soon close Russian borders to men of fighting age are fueling panic and prompting more to flee. Zelensky, in his nightly address on Sunday, described Russia's mobilization as criminal and reiterated his call for Russians to stand up to it. "Fight so that they don't send your children to die, all of those who they can take in this criminal Russian mobilization," Zelensky said, switching to Russian for a brief portion of his speech. "Because if you come to take the lives of our children, I will tell you as a father, we will not let you go alive." German officials have voiced a desire to help Russian men deserting military service and have called for a European-wide solution. Now, moving to today's editorial page, this is a guest column by Iowa Senator Joni Ernst. It's headlined, "Ernst, Democrats' Priorities Misplaced, Says Additional IRS Agents Will Create Problems for the Rest of America." In almost every single county I visit on my 99-county tour, I see help wanted signs. From public schools to the National Guard, Iowa is facing a shortage of nearly every essential worker our economy depends on. Sadly, Democrats' response to the nationwide need for essential workers is to bloat our bureaucracy even more, to the tune of 87,000 IRS agents. And no matter what the liberal talking heads say, these agents are not going to stick to auditing billionaires and the top tier of the tax code. The nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office, CBO, says that, thanks to the supersized staff, the IRS audit rate would rise for all taxpayers, regardless of income. The CBO also warns that this could result in the incorrect audit of Americans who do not owe the IRS a cent. Ironically, while the IRS is gearing up to come after innocent Americans, employees inside the agency itself may have willfully failed to pay their own tax bills, including a tax collector and even a criminal investigator. In total, 1,250 IRS employees were flagged for not paying their tax bills in full or on time. And get this, one of their excuses for the offense was that they were unable to use TurboTax. Folks, we have a real problem if the IRS staff who enforce the tax law are not paying their own taxes and cannot even understand how to properly fill out their own tax forms. America does not need more IRS agents. We need to simplify the tax code. I've heard enough of the excuses and these Washington double standards. In August, I asked the Treasury Inspector General for Tax Administration to audit the IRS to look into this issue and ensure no more employees on their payroll were avoiding paying taxes they owe. Today, on behalf of taxpayers in Iowa and the rest of the country, I'm happy to report that the Inspector General has agreed to audit the IRS. If the threat of being audited was not bad enough, Iowans' taxes and cost of living continues to rise. We saw inflation rise to 8.5% just last month, with the cost of food and groceries continuing to skyrocket. Meanwhile, there's a wide-open southern border that's pouring record amounts of illegal immigrants and drugs throughout our community. I don't know about you, but I think we could use 87,000 new Border Patrol agents, not IRS agents. What all this boils down to is that Democrats' misplaced priorities are creating problems for the rest of America. But you can rest assured I will keep fighting back and standing up for hardworking taxpayers across the country. Before Biden's army of auditors starts harassing us, let's make sure the tax collectors themselves have paid their own taxes. And that's what I'm doing with my audit of the IRS. Again, that's an opinion piece on today's editorial page by U.S. Senator Joni Ernst, a Republican who represents Iowa. Next on today's editorial page, is a column by national syndicated columnist Mark Thiessen. It's headlined, "If the Panic is Over, So is Biden's Authority to Forgive Student Debt." President Biden declared that the pandemic is over and now is trying to walk it back. Little wonder. With just a few words in a 60 Minutes interview, Biden completely undermined his administration's legal justification for student loan forgiveness. The nonpartisan Penn Wharton budget model estimates that Biden's loan forgiveness plan will cost between $605 billion and $1 trillion. Congress has not authorized him to spend any of that, so where does the president get the authority to unilaterally spend up to $1 trillion? He claims to find it in the HEROES Act, a law passed after the 9/11 attacks to help those Americans called up to active military service not default on their student loans. The law provides the Secretary of Education with specific waiver authority to respond to a war or other military operation or national emergency, my emphasis. In an August memo explaining the legal basis for Biden's student loan forgiveness plan, Education Department General Counsel Lisa Brown claimed that emergency authority includes a national emergency such as the present COVID-19 pandemic. This is absurd. The HEROES Act explicitly states that it is intended to help the hundreds of thousands of Army, Air Force, Marine Corps, Navy, and Coast Guard reservists and members of the National Guard who have been called to active duty or active service. It authorizes the Secretary of Education to forgive or modify their loans in response to a national emergency, regardless of the location at which such active duty service is performed. There's no way to read this law as justifying debt relief for an entire class of individuals who never wore the uniform. Biden is not even trying to conform with the intent of the law by, for example, perhaps extending loan forgiveness to first responders and frontline medical workers who risk their lives during the COVID-19 pandemic. He's driving a steam engine right through the plain text of the law and providing mass debt forgiveness for those who did not serve in any capacity in a national emergency and using the pandemic as justification. But now that Biden has declared the pandemic over, his justification for abusing this law has evaporated. Walking through the Detroit Auto Show, Biden told CBS correspondent Scott Pelley, "If you notice, no one's wearing masks. Everyone seems to be in pretty good shape." He said, "We still have a problem with COVID. We're still doing a lot of work on it, but the pandemic is over." That means that what his administration's lawyers called a national emergency, such as the present COVID-19 pandemic, is no longer present. And if the pandemic is no longer present, neither is the legal basis for using it to forgive student loans. Of course, consistency has never been Biden's strong suit. In the spring, his administration announced it was lifting Title 42, the Trump-era public health order that allows border officials to turn away illegal migrants in order to prevent the spread of COVID-19, because Biden's Centers for Disease Control and Prevention declared it was no longer necessary, since we now have an increased availability of tools to fight COVID-19, and 97.1% of the U.S. population lives in a county identified as having low COVID-19 community level. In other words, Biden effectively declared the pandemic emergency over for illegal migrants at the border, but then a few months later invoked it to justify student loan forgiveness. Then he again declared the pandemic over, even as his administration submits an emergency request to Congress for $27 billion in pandemic spending before the end of the year. The formal pandemic emergency declaration expires on October 13th, unless Biden extends it for an additional 3 months. If he fails to do so, then not only will he no longer have legal justification for student debt forgiveness, but he will also lose the basis for other pandemic-justified social spending, such as the emergency Medicaid expansion, which the nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office estimates added to the program some 13 million Americans who would otherwise make too much money to qualify, at a cost of nearly $10 billion a month. So, in all likelihood, Biden will follow his declaration that the pandemic is over by soon extending the pandemic emergency declaration. Because if Republicans regain the majority in just one House in November, the ability to pass Democrats-only spending bills will evaporate, which means the pandemic emergency will be all Democrats have left to continue their miasma of fiscal profligacy. Again, that is a column by nationally syndicated columnist Mark Thiessen on today's Messenger editorial page. And now here is one of today's hints from Heloise. Library books. Dear Heloise, years ago, when my uncle went to the library and checked out a book he really enjoyed, he'd leave a $5 or $10 bill between the pages. This was something he really loved to do, especially around Christmas time. When I suggested he leave a note for the reader to let them know the money was for them, he began to paperclip or staple a small piece of paper to the money that would say, "Enjoy, just for you," or "A gift from Santa." This small act of kindness brought him so much joy that he continued to do it until the last days of his life. You are listening to the reading of the Fort Dodge Messenger for Monday, September 26, 2022, on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. Now let's turn to today's obituaries. Amanda Sue Deal, 37, of Fort Dodge, passed away on Wednesday, the 21st day of September. A celebration of life will be held on Thursday, September 29th, at 10:30 a.m. at Laufersweiler Seavers Funeral Home. Visitation will be Wednesday, September 28th from 4 to 7 p.m. at the funeral home. Survivors include daughter Adeline Mikesell, dad Bruce Alexander, brothers Jacob Meredith Ayala and Isaiah Alexander, sisters Kayla Levi Ewing, Hannah and Allison Lara, grandmother Teresa Alexander, and many nieces, aunts, uncles, and cousins. Amanda was preceded in death by her mom, Mickey Deal, grandparents Herbert and Betty Deal, Grandpa Smokey Alexander. Amanda graduated from Fort Dodge Senior High in 2004. She worked in long-term health care and child care. Amanda enjoyed caring for others, cooking, and painting, although she was no Picasso. Her hobbies included night fishing with stinky chicken liver and playing fruit machines at the local watering holes. Amanda enjoyed celebrating Christmas starting in July. Her free spirit is unrivaled, and her humor will continue as part of her legacy. Taken before her time, Amanda will be deeply missed by all who loved her. Richard S. Sulzbach, 75, of Fort Dodge, passed away Sunday, September 25, 2022, at the Friendship Haven Nursing Home. Services are pending. Laufersweiler Funeral Home will be serving the family. Sharon Peterson, 66, of Fort Dodge, passed away on Sunday, September 25, 2022, at Mary Greeley Medical Center in Ames. Services are pending. Laufersweiler Funeral Home is serving the family. Jean M. Selhaber passed away on Sunday, September 25, 2022, at the Marion Home. Services are pending. Laufersweiler Seavers Funeral Home is serving the family. And there are two names in today's Laufersweiler advertisement on the obituary page that are not included in today's obituaries. They are Betty Messerly, age 97, services pending. David Allen, age 82, services pending. That concludes today's obituaries. Moving on to sports, our first article headline reads, Iowa Central football versus DuPage, celebration. Tritons cap homecoming week with big victory, by Chris Johnson. It was a different feel to homecoming week for 7th-ranked NJCAA Division II Iowa Central, but in the end, the Tritons capped off the festivities with an efficient rout of College of DuPage. With a band competition inside Dodger Stadium on Saturday, the Tritons, 3-1 overall, took Sunday's time slot and throttled the NJCAA Division III defending national champions and the nation's top-ranked squad at that level, 53-3. It was a little weird playing on a Sunday, said ICCC head coach Jesse Montalto. It seems like our pep rally was a long time ago, but there were no distractions, and we had our walkthrough Saturday instead. We cleaned some things up, but we still have a lot of work we need to do. Iowa Central racked up 635 yards of total offense, passing for 374 and running for 261 more. Montalto got efficient performances from quarterback Zach Marker and Justin Silverstein. Marker played the entire first half, while Silverstein played the third quarter and stretches of the fourth. The duo combined to go 20 for 23 for 333 yards and 6 touchdown passes. Those two, Marker and Silverstein, are our leaders, Montalto said. They are guys who know how to run our offense. They command a presence. Marker led a two-play drive to open the game, capped off by a 51-yard strike to Cal Wiedemann for the first score. Marker also connected on a beautiful touch pass by hitting Desna Washington from 23 yards out. On Iowa Central's final possession of the half, Marker hit Wiedemann for 4 yards out to give the Tritons a 29-0 lead before a 22-yard DuPage field goal. Walter Wilbon had a 21-yard TD run on a one-play possession after the Tritons stopped the Chaparrals in the red zone. Marker finished the game 12 for 15 for 194 yards and 3 touchdown passes. I feel we had good energy against a team that played well against Ellsworth, Montalto said. We still have some things I would like to see us get better at, though, especially in the red zone. The Tritons marched downfield to begin the second half, and Silverstein capped a six-play, 64-yard drive with a 15-yard strike to Jamarian Wheeler. Silverstein hit Wheeler again from 8 yards out for the pair's second touchdown. George Sims got in on the scoring with a 14-yard catch from Silverstein. Silverstein was a perfect 8 for 8, throwing for 139 yards and 3 scores. Wiedemann caught 4 balls for 85 yards, and Wheeler had 3 catches for 63. Sims and Washington finished with 55 yards receiving each. Walter Wilbon, 73 yards, Jaden Washington, 62, and Marker, 60, were the leading rushers for the Tritons. Kongolo Mwenekamba, 21 yards, and Liam Wehe, 35 yards, had field goals for Iowa Central. On the defensive side of the ball, the Tritons held the Chaparrals to 73 yards passing. Mames Williams and Diego Cortez recovered fumbles. The Tritons are back in action this Saturday, October 8th, when they travel to Coffeyville. And here's today's state roundup feature, which features other Iowa College football scores. UNI gets on the board. Macomb, Illinois. Theo Day threw 3 touchdown passes to lead Northern Iowa to its first win of the season, a 52-17 victory over Western Illinois on Saturday. Day was 23 of 29, passing for 260 yards. He threw a pair of touchdown passes to Desmond Hudson and one to Quan Hampton, each from inside the red zone. Dom Williams and Harrison Bay Buey each had a short yardage scoring run combined for 118 yards rushing on 25 carries for Northern Iowa 1-3-1-1 Missouri Valley Football Conference. Clay Bruno threw for 166 yards with a touchdown and 3 interceptions for Western Illinois 0-4-0-1. Bruno's 47-yard touchdown pass to Jalen Reed pulled the Leathernecks to 17-10 early in the third quarter. Drake suffers heartbreaking loss. Des Moines. Ammon Woods scored on a 6-yard run with 43 seconds to play to lift Marist to a wild 30-25 win over Drake on Saturday in a Pioneer Football League opener between winless teams. Woods capped a 14-play, 80-yard drive that included a fourth-down conversion when quarterback Brock Bagazzi went 10 yards on a keeper at midfield. A field goal made it 24-13 before the Bulldogs, 0-4, rallied with 15 unanswered points. Luke Williams kicked a pair of short field goals before Dorian Boylan scored on a 2-yard run to pull Drake within 27-25. Now moving on to Division I college football. Number 17, Baylor holds off Cyclones 31-24. Ames. A tough loss 2 weeks ago prepared number 17 Baylor for Saturday's Big 12 opener at Iowa State. After a double overtime defeat at BYU, Bears quarterback Blake Shapen was ready for a rowdy Jack Tri-Stadium crowd and was the catalyst for a 31-24 victory over the Cyclones. "We struggled a little bit at BYU with the noise and things like that," Shapen said after throwing for 238 yards and 3 touchdowns against Iowa State. "People look at that and don't give it too much credit at times, but it's always a big win when you go on the road in conference." The loss snapped the Iowa State's 11-game home winning streak against Big 12 rivals. "I know it's a tough place to play," Baylor coach Dave Aranda said. "It's just a difficult place. They never beat themselves. You have to win it." Shapen completed 19 of his 26 passes, connecting with 11 receivers. Gavin Holmes finished with 3 catches for 92 yards, including a 38-yard touchdown in the fourth quarter. "We were never able to control the momentum of the football game early on," Iowa State coach Matt Campbell said. "We needed to be better." The Bears, 3-1, seized control midway through the third quarter, driving 93 yards in 10 plays and taking a 24-14 lead on Richard Reese's 19-yard touchdown run. Iowa State, 3-1, was undone by 2 interceptions and averaging just 2.4 yards per rush. "Today was a great example of complementary football," Bears linebacker Bryson Jackson said. The Cyclones scored 10 points in the final 7.5 minutes, but the Bears held firm, drawing from their experience at BYU. "BYU was definitely a learning lesson," Baylor linebacker Bryson Jackson said. "It definitely prepared us for today. We didn't beat ourselves." The Bears finished with more than a 9-minute edge in time of possession. The takeaway. Baylor. The Bears found success against a solid Iowa State defense. The Cyclones topped the Big 12 through 3 non-conference games by allowing an average of 234.3 yards, including holding their last 2 opponents under the 300-yard mark. The Bears netted 273 yards through the first three quarters and covered 68 or more yards on four of their first six full possessions. They finished with 361 total yards. Iowa State. Deckers threw for 284 yards and two touchdowns, but Baylor had him under pressure. He was sacked four times, twice by Jackson. Poll implications. Number 17 Baylor should continue to rebound in the top 25. The Bears began the season as a top 10 team, but lost at BYU on September 10th in double overtime before bouncing back. Up next, Baylor hosts number 9 Oklahoma State next Saturday. Iowa State travels to unbeaten Kansas. Iowa takes care of business at Rutgers, 27-10, by Tom Canavan of the Associated Press, Piscataway, New Jersey. In a game featuring two outstanding defenses, Iowa won the turnover battle by a wide margin. Cooper DeJean scored on a 45-yard interception return, and Kevon Merriweather returned a fumble 30 yards for another first-half touchdown, as Iowa rode its defense to 27-10 victory over Rutgers on Saturday night. LaShawn Williams scored on a 2-yard run, and Drew Stevens kicked two field goals as the Hawkeyes, 3-1-1-0, forced three turnovers and handed Rutgers, 3-1-0-1, its 20th straight Big Ten conference loss at home. Evan Simon, the only healthy scholarship quarterback with Noah Vedral and Gavin Wimsert hurt, threw an 18-yard touchdown pass to Aaron Cruikshank early in the fourth quarter with Rutgers down 24-3. Jude McCatney kicked a 28-yard field goal on the opening series for the Scarlet Knights, who were looking for their first 4-0 start since 2012. Rutgers appeared ready to challenge Iowa on the opening series, but turning the ball over three times against a defense that allowed 13 points in its first three games was not the way to win. The 23 points allowed by Iowa in the first four games is its fewest points allowed in the last 66 years. The Hawkeyes gave up 20 points in their first four games in 1956. That's pretty impressive, so clearly the guys are playing at a high level right now, doing a good job, Iowa coach Kirk Ferentz said. And the two defensive touchdowns, it did feel a little bit like the Indiana game, September 2021, because that's the last time we did that too, so lots to be pleased about there. DeJean, who now has interceptions in three straight games, made an over-the-shoulder catch on a deep hurried pass by Simon with about 6 minutes left in the opening quarter. He turned, cut across the field, eluded a couple of tacklers, and scored for a 7-3 lead. I caught the ball on one hash, so I knew everybody would come to that side, DeJean said. All the linemen, I don't want to get into there with those big boys, so I just cut to the other side of the field and saw there was a lot of grass over there. Merriweather, who also had an interception, got the defense's second touchdown and stretched the lead to 14-3 with 8:28 left in the half. Safety Sebastian Castro forced a fumble by Joshua Youngblood after an 18-yard reception, and Merriweather picked up the ball and had a clear path to the end zone. Castro did all the work. I got the easy end of the stick. It was a great play, Merriweather said of his first college TD. Stevens stretched the lead to 17-3 with a 25-yard field goal just before halftime, and Williams tallied on the opening possession of the third quarter. Stevens added a 51-yard field goal in the fourth quarter with a goalpost assist. Rutgers outgained Iowa 361-277, but the Hawkeyes won the turnover battle 3-0. We turned the ball over, and when you do that, you know it rewrites the story immediately, Rutgers coach Greg Schiano said. Simon finished 28-49 for 300 yards and the touchdown despite being under a lot of pressure. Losing is never okay, especially in a program like this, he said. You know, we set the standard really high, and it's unacceptable. The takeaway. Iowa. The Hawkeyes' defense was outstanding for the fourth straight game. However, playing that way next week against one of the top teams in the country will be a major test. Iowa also needs more from its offense to challenge the league. Rutgers. The Scarlet Knights showed flashes on offense, but the turnovers were the difference, not having either Noah Vedral or Gavin Wimsett, both injured, to provide a change of pace at quarterback hurt. The defense seemed to wear with little help from the offense. Defense. The last time Iowa had two defensive TDs in a game was early last season against Indiana, when Riley Moss had two pick sixes against Indiana. The Hawkeyes have scored on an interception return in 15 straight seasons and 20 of 22. The defensive touchdowns were the first of the year for Iowa. The unit scored 28 points last season. Moving on to other sports, Reddick ends long day with cup win by Stephen Hawkins. Fort Worth, Texas. Tyler Reddick opened the round of 12 in NASCAR's playoff with a victory at Texas on Sunday, winning a week after being one of the first four Cup drivers knocked out of title contention. After none of the contenders won the first three races of the playoffs, a first in any round in this postseason format, the trend continued with the eliminated Reddick being 53 of the final 54 laps on a long race day that went into the night. Reddick finished 1.19 seconds ahead of Joey Logano at the end of an extended race that had a track record 17 cautions, a record 36 lead changes, and a 56-minute red flag for lightning and multiple tire issues leading to crashes, including playoff contenders Chase Elliott, the points leader going into the second round, and Christopher Bell. "I was extremely worried. I'm not going to lie," Reddick said. "Unfortunately, just about every time we've had fast cars, we've had some tire problems. That last run, the right sides were vibrating really, really hard there. I was just trying to maximize and use the gap that I built over Logano just in case." Logano took over the points lead by 12 over Ross Chastain. Elliott, who entered the round of 12 as the points leader, had a fiery finish after contact with the outside wall in turn 4 when leading just past the halfway mark of the race. Flames were already visible from under the right side of the number 9 Chevrolet when he got onto the front stretch, then turned across and came to a stop in the middle of the infield, where Elliott climbed out uninjured as the car was being engulfed by flames. He finished 32nd. "I'm not sure that Goodyear is at fault," Elliott said. "Goodyear always takes the black eye, but they're put in a really tough position by NASCAR to build a tire that can survive these types of racetracks with this car. I wouldn't blame Goodyear." Non-playoff drivers Kevin Harvick and Martin Truex Jr. also had tire issues when leading the race at the 1.5-mile track. And now for a change of pace, here is today's Dear Annie advice column. Memory Care Centers Superior to Assisted Living. Dear Annie, I want to share a story with you and your readers about a resource that has helped our family tremendously. They are called Memory Care Centers, which is an alternative to assisted living. In 1998, my sister and I were informed that the agency handling the 24/7 home care for my dad, who had Alzheimer's, could no longer work with him because he was having too many falls in his house. They requested that we find other arrangements for him. My sister's son located a brand new facility in suburban St. Paul, Minnesota. He was their first patient, and they treated him like a prince. The facility was within walking distance of my nephew's house. My dad had a private corner room with two large windows and a very comfortable hospital-style bed. The room had a television and private bathroom, and my sister bought an electric lift reclining chair for him when he wanted to watch TV, take a nap, or just relax. He put up pictures of family as well as some of the buildings his company had built over the years. I got my first look at it about a month later when we were cleaning out my dad's Minnesota condo. I was absolutely amazed at how wonderful this place was. There was a dining room where everyone could eat their meals together if they wanted. They even prepared special meals for him whenever they were serving something that was on his allergy list. They had an ice cream shop, barber, beauty shop, library, and social room with a large screen TV. They had a courtyard completely surrounded by the building where people could go out and sit in the sun with no fear of them wandering off alone. The front door had a buzzer system that could only be activated by the receptionist to let visitors in and out. My sister and any of her adult children could pick him up and take him out for dinner or to family events anytime they wanted. In earlier years, I saw my grandparents and later my mother-in-law in a nursing home situation, and it just turned my stomach. These facilities are a far cry from most nursing homes. I remember that on the first day I visited, my father was with a group of people who were trying to carve pumpkins. I had never, ever seen my dad try to carve a pumpkin, and it was hysterical, and he was having a good time. The next day, they had a music therapist visiting and were singing all the songs that were popular when they were young. And for the record, my two sons both know that if I am unfortunate enough to develop any form of dementia and can't stay in my own home safely, they should find a facility for me exactly like the one my dad was in. Signed, Memory Care. Dear Memory Care, thank you for your letter. I hope it helps others in similar situations. Going to a home that specializes in the type of care that your dad needed sounds like a great idea, and you just found the right place. You have a right to feel relieved and grateful, and we appreciate your sharing your story. Finding the right memory care facility or nursing home or assisted living facility for our elderly relatives is one of the most important decisions any of us can make. Kudos to you for helping your dad and possibly yourself if you were to develop dementia later in life. Now here's today's This Date in History feature by the Associated Press. Today is Monday, September 26th, the 269th day of 2022. There are 96 days left in the year. Today's highlight in history. On September 26, 1960, the first ever debate between presidential nominees took place as Democrat John F. Kennedy and Republican Richard M. Nixon faced off before a national TV audience from Chicago. On this date in 1777, British troops occupied Philadelphia during the American Revolution. In 1888, poet T.S. Eliot was born in St. Louis, Missouri. In 1954, the Japanese commercial ferry Toya Maru sank during a typhoon in the Tsugaru Strait, claiming more than 1,150 lives. In 1986, William H. Rehnquist was sworn in as the 16th Chief Justice of the United States, while Antonin Scalia joined the Supreme Court as its 103rd member. In 1991, four men and four women began a two-year stay inside a sealed-off structure in Oracle, Arizona, called Biosphere 2. They emerged from Biosphere on this date in 1993. In 1996, President Clinton signed a bill ensuring two-day hospital stays for new mothers and their babies. In 2005, Army PFC Lindy England was convicted by a military jury in Fort Hood, Texas, on 6 of 7 counts stemming from the Abu Ghraib prison abuse scandal. England was sentenced to 3 years in prison. She ended up serving half that time. In 2008, Hollywood screen legend and philanthropist Paul Newman died in Westport, Connecticut at age 83. In 2020, President Donald Trump nominated Judge Amy Coney Barrett, a former clerk to the late Justice Antonin Scalia, to the Supreme Court to fill the seat left vacant by the death of liberal icon Ruth Bader Ginsburg. Barrett would be confirmed the following month, days before the November election. More than 150 people gathered in the Rose Garden for Trump's introduction of Barrett. Few in the crowd wore masks to protect against the coronavirus, and in the days that followed, a succession of attendees reported that they had contracted COVID-19. 5 years ago, amid criticism that the federal response to Hurricane Maria in Puerto Rico was insufficient, the administration said it was sending a flotilla of ships and thousands more military personnel to the island to address the growing humanitarian crisis there. 1 year ago, the Rolling Stones launched their pandemic-delayed No Filter tour in St. Louis without their drummer of nearly six decades, Charlie Watts, who had died in August at age 80. And here's the hot corner, which is on this date in sports. 1961, New York Yankee Roger Maris ties Babe Ruth's 34-year-old record with a 60th homer off Jack Fisher of Baltimore. 1981, Nolan Ryan of the Houston Astros becomes the first player to pitch 5 no-hit, no-run games. This one is a 5-0 victory over the Los Angeles Dodgers at the Astrodome. 1992, Rocky Mountain's Steve Thompson rushes for 405 yards and 6 touchdowns in a 42-36 overtime victory over Carroll College. The rushing total is the second highest in NAIA history. 1998, Prairie View A&M ends its NCAA record 80-game losing streak by stopping a 2-point conversion in the final minute for a 14-12 victory over Langston. The victory is the Panthers' first since October 28, 1989, when they defeated Mississippi Valley 21-12. 2000, at the Sydney Olympics, the U.S. softball team completes a stunning comeback by edging Japan 2-1 in extra innings to win its second straight gold medal. 2015, Aaron Green catches a tipped pass in the back of the end zone with 23 seconds left, and number 3 TCU outlasts Texas Tech 55-52 in the Big 12 opener for both teams. On 4th and goal from the 4, Trevor Boykin throws 4 touchdown passes and finishes with a career-high 509 yards for TCU. And finally, a few more hints from Heloise. Switch gas cars for electric. Today's sound off concerns the future of gas-fed cars. Dear Heloise, we've landed a man on the moon and made advances in medicine, so why are we still using gasoline-guzzling cars? We have the ability to use electric cars, and we could and should help advance this method of transportation. Just think of all the steel used in cars that could be used in other projects. Think of how cleaner our air would be if gas fumes were gone. Add to this a vehicle that's priced low enough to make electric cars affordable to everyone. There are also companies working on drones that can carry passengers. This isn't just some futuristic dream. It will take a while, but with enough funding from the government, it could be a reality in about 10 to 20 years. One day, we might even see homes with landing pads. We live on one planet, and we can't count on Mars or the moon to become a second home. The reality of this has already begun to sink in as more and more couples decide to limit the size of their families. Now is the time to get very serious about cleaning up the oceans and air for future generations. We all need to recycle and reuse items we have. I sincerely hope one day there will be no fields of rotting old abandoned cars or acres of abandoned motorcycles. Yes, they do exist all over the world. Remember, Earth is your home, and it's time for a good and thorough home cleaning. Victor T., Portland, Oregon. Victor, I agree with you, which is why we here at Heloise Central encourage recycling. And that does it for today's reading of the Fort Dodge Messenger for Monday, September 26, 2022. I'm your reader, Janet Griffith. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org, anytime. Thanks for listening.